Pursuing Sexual Purity in Sodom, the seventh talk in a series titled Sodom and Sexual Purity, was presented by David Crabtree on February 18, 2003, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
Okay, I'm going to begin by dealing with some definitional matters. First of all, I'd like to talk a little bit about what I mean by sexual purity. And I'm sure that has been talked about in bits and pieces probably throughout this whole series, so I won't spend a lot of time, but I do want to talk about that a little bit. Then I want to talk about what do I mean by Sodom, what qualifies as a Sodom, and that is a topic I think that would warrant a lot of discussion, but I will just talk about it briefly. And then I want to talk about what I'm going to argue is that we are living in a time of Sodom. And in fact, the culture in which we live is the most powerful culture and the most powerful Sodom, in a sense, that has ever existed. And I want to develop that a little bit. And then finally, I want to talk about how it is that we can resist the influences of Sodom. If all goes well, I plan to paint a rather dreary picture of the culture in which we live. So then my last task is to figure out how to get us out of it. So I want to discuss what we can do. Now, I have tried to carefully craft my lecture so that I leave two or three questions unanswered, and that there will be time for that after I'm done. What is sexual purity? What is it that we are to be pursuing? I think generally when people hear the term sexual purity, they think in terms of refraining from certain kinds of sexual perversions. If that were the case, then the solution, the way to pursue sexual purity, would be to lock yourself in your room. This is a kind of purity of the body, and I think that is too low a goal. That's not the goal that would be the biblical standard. The kind of sexual purity that we're talking about is a much more profound concept, and it's a much higher goal. As Jesus, when he talked about adultery, said that it is not enough to just refrain from having sexual relations with another man's wife. That merely lustful thoughts cause one to be guilty of having committed adultery already. It's that kind of standard of sexual purity that we ought to be pursuing, and that's the one that I'm talking about. Which means, and it is sobering to keep this in mind, this means that a lustful glance is a violation of sexual purity. A flirtatious flip of the hair is a violation of sexual purity. Brief, inappropriate thoughts is a violation of sexual purity. Taking one's spouse for granted is a violation of sexual purity. So the standard that we're talking about is a very high standard. It is nothing less than complete and unfailing devotion to the principles of God. It's purity in every thought and every deed. and it all centers on valuing what God values. So that's the goal. That when we're talking about sexual purity, that's what we're talking about. Now, I want to make a few comments about this purity of the body versus sexual purity. One can be pure in the body and be sexually impure. Many years ago, I was working with a group of missionaries in Rome. And we had some interns come and spend the summer with us, helping us with our ministry. And there were two girls who came from a Bible college in South Carolina. And this was a very strict Bible college in which they had very strict rules on what they could do, and in particular, in any kind of relations between boys and girls. And they had the notorious 6-inch rule, that you had to stay, girls had to stay 6 inches or further from any males. What was striking to me is that two of the girls that came over were some of the most flirtatious girls I have ever met. And what, as I reflected on it, what has happened is they had developed to a high art the ability to be seductive at a distance of 6 inches. Which is amazing. But that is purity of the body, but it's not sexual purity. Contrary-wise, on the other hand, one can be impure in body and be sexually pure. And here's what I mean by that. There are few things in life, at least in my experience, that are more guilt-producing than sexual sin. Any kind of sexual indiscretion is very guilt-producing. And as a result, I think we attach, there's a stigma that comes with sexual sin, that it is less forgivable than other kinds of sin. But I think it's very clear that even sexual sin is forgivable. God is merciful, and He forgives us our sins. And if we are repentant of our sins, He is faithful and just to forgive us of those sins. Which means that one who has been forgiven of their sins, they are pure. So in that sense, it is possible to have been impure in the body and be pure. Okay, having made those comments, the pursuit of sexual purity, to sum it up, is the desire with every fiber of one's being to be faithful to the principles of God with respect to sexuality. To do and think what is good and proper. And when we fail, we ask God for forgiveness, and then we carry on. That's what it means to pursue sexual purity. What do I mean then by living in a Sodom? What would it mean to live in a Sodom? Pursuing sexual purity has always been difficult. That's inherent in being a human being. It's one of the strongest, the desire to have intimacy with another human being, to know someone intimately and to be known intimately, is one of the strongest desires that we have. That's built into us, that has never changed, and as a result, that has always brought challenges with it. And as sinners, we want to have these desires fulfilled in ways that seem good to us. And as a result, we are sorely tempted, time after time, to find fulfillment of those desires through illicit means, and to exploit that desire on the part of others to manipulate them for our purposes. Those are temptations that we can't pass up, that we all give into those temptations from one time to another. And this has been true as long as men have been sinners, which dates back quite a way. So that part, that's the same. That hasn't changed. So what is different? What is a Sodom then? How is a Sodom different? Well, our surrounding culture can either encourage us to keep those desires within constraints, or it can encourage us to act out on those desires. The surrounding culture has a great deal with how we deal with those desires. The culture that's around us affects all of us to a degree that I don't think any of us fully realize. It shapes the way that we look at the world. It shapes what we value and how we value it. Now, many of you are probably aware of the fact that culture has a huge impact on us. But some of you may not be. And one of the illustrations that comes to mind readily when I think about this is just, I will simply ask the question, is efficiency good? If you've grown up in America, you have absorbed the value that efficiency is good. And it's the kind of thing that you never even stop and think about unless you go to another culture where efficiency is not valued whatsoever. And it raises the question, if you say that it's good, why? And that's a question that otherwise would never occur to us. We absorb things from our culture all the time. And it becomes a part of our way of thinking without us ever examining it. And as a result, we are products of our culture, and our culture has an enormous influence on the way that we see the world. And one of the most important things historically that a culture can do is to encourage its members to exercise self-control. And one important area of self-control is with respect to sexuality. A Sodom is a society in which the sexual impulses of its members does not encourage its members to constrain those. The first thing that comes to mind when you hear the term Sodom, I think, is sexual licentiousness. That the story of Sodom in Genesis is one in which the people of Sodom were given over to the pursuit of sexual pleasure. But I don't think the pursuit of sexual pleasure is really at the heart of what Sodom is. There's something even more fundamental. And that is a profound narcissism. In the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, when the angels go to Sodom and they visit Lot, Lot, remember, will not allow them to spend the night in the city square because he knows what would happen to them. He insists that they come to his house, and they are finally persuaded to do so. So they are in his house, and the people, the men of Sodom, it says, come from all the quarters of the city, and they come to Lot's house, and they knock on the door, and they insist that Lot send these strangers, these visitors, out to them. And Lot bravely steps outside, and he says, no, don't do this wicked thing. And their response is, I think, rather chilling. I mean, that whole scene, as you read it in Genesis, is just creepy. It's the kind of scene where if you think about it, you feel dirty. And they say, send the men out, or we will do the same to you. They're speaking to Lot. Well, obviously, they've turned what they're going to do to these guests into a threat against Lot. They're up to no good. And one of the things that's really powerful in that passage is they do not care. They have no sympathy for other people and the pain that they are going to inflict on these guests makes no difference to them. They are just bent on their own pursuit of sexual pleasure. So it's an extreme narcissism that's behind it all. And I think that's what's at the root of a Sodom, is people in pursuit of their own pleasure. It's a selfishness, a deep-rooted selfishness. So, as we look for Sodoms, I think what we need to look for is, where do you find that deep-rooted selfishness? It's going to manifest itself in sexual licentiousness, but the root of it is that narcissism, that selfishness. Now, the problem with a culture that is narcissistic is it can't last long. Any society that's narcissistic is going to turn on itself. So Sodoms don't last long. I mean, historically, Sodoms don't last long. However, it is possible for a society to have a deep-seated narcissism and yet extend its lifespan by organizing itself in such a way that it maximizes one's ability to pursue sensual pleasure while maintaining some kind of minimum of civility. If we can put society together in such a way that we maintain some level of ability to work together, and yet people can pursue their own selfishness, that is a narcissistic society that can endure for a period of time. One of the things that's really important, one of the things that's true of us as creatures made in the image of God, I believe, is that we feel a need to be just. We feel a need to be right. It is interesting to me that no matter how heinous the crime, the criminal always has a justification for why it was done. Some way to justify it, some way to make it right. One of the things that society then can do is be self-supporting. That I do my wickedness and people approve me for it in exchange for me approving them for them doing their wickedness. That there's a sense of justification that can come from us approving of one another's evil. So, an enduring narcissistic society would be one in which it is possible for us to live our lives in comfort and allow us to feel good and just about ourselves while allowing us to be essentially narcissistic. And that is a society in which love grows cold, as it talks about in the New Testament. I used to think that the epitome of a rotten society, a thoroughly wicked society, would be one that would just devolve into chaos and people killing each other. I have since become convinced that that's not the quintessential evil society. The quintessential evil society is going to be one that is outwardly proper, but internally rotten. That there will be this civility and decorum that will embellish it, but nevertheless being inwardly rotten. The kind of thing that I have in mind is a Hitler Germany, in which you have outward decorum and propriety, and yet a society that has been organized and is complicit in, if not acquiescent in, enormous evil. Now, that then is, I believe, the quintessential Sodom. It's an enduring selfish society. Only in modern times has there been the configuration of factors that have made it possible for a large-scale society to come into being which is characterized by this kind of selfishness. And I've coined a new term for it that I'm kind of fond of, enlightened narcissism. The modern world has made enlightened narcissism possible. And I want to talk about what are the confluence of factors that have come together. And I am going to steal heavily from Jacques Ellul in this. The first thing that one needs to understand is that we are living in a time in which society has embraced a set of values, a world view, loosely speaking, which I'll call modernization. It's the modern worldview. This is qualitatively different from society's past. We have made a rather abrupt change with the advent of modernization. Our life, our way of life has changed dramatically, and that change in our way of life has made changes in society, and it has meant that the means by which mankind, human beings, used to gain a sense of value and purpose, that has all been stripped away from us. And now we're left orphaned, in a sense. We don't have those things. And the result has been a world has emerged that is not well suited to human existence. We do not have, it is difficult for human beings in our time to find a sense of meaning, to find a sense of belonging, to find a sense of direction, a sense of connection with other people, a sense that we're valued or invaluable. Prior to the advent of modernization, there were social structures, family structures that provided some sense of all of those things to people. A sense of meaning, a sense of belonging, a sense of direction and connection and value. Largely that was through the family. And to the extent that it wasn't through the family, it was through the village. And to the extent that it wasn't through the village, then it was through the larger community. But those social structures provided us with these things that we as human beings all need. With the changes that have taken place in society, we can no longer get those from the places where they used to come, from the family and the village. So people are desperate for some source from which they can get these things that we as human beings all need. So that's the dilemma that modern society faces us with. We have created an environment in which we as human beings are physically comfortable, but psychologically and emotionally, we are in a sorely wanting. Okay, so we desperately need some things. At a time when the modern state also desperately needs something. In the modern world, democracy has emerged as the dominant, I'm going to say, perspective. It's a set of values. I mean, when I say democracy, I'm talking about a set of values. In particular, the perspective that all human beings are equal. And in the modern world, democracy has emerged as the dominant way of looking at society. We are all equal, and since we are all equal, we all deserve an equal say in how our society is governed and how it is run. The problem with that is democracy is inherently unstable. If everyone has a say in how things are run, anything you vote on, you've got innumerable different views on that particular issue. People's perspectives are all over the map. And to the extent that people don't share a common worldview and a common understanding of the purpose of society, you have even more disparity in where they think society ought to go and what decisions ought to be made. As a result, a society that's run by public opinion ends up being all over the map. There's no consistency, there's no coherence, it changes from one day to the next. And a society can't operate with that kind of uncertainty. As a result, modern societies are becoming painfully aware of the fact that there needs to be some kind of leadership. Society needs to be provided with direction, a course of action. However, given democratic values, no one is willing to give up the value of all of us having an equal say in how society is governed. So, what the modern state wants desperately is some means by which to direct public opinion. Okay, so we as people desperately need to be provided with the illusion that we're valuable, the some kind of purpose, some sense of belonging, etc., etc. The state desperately needs some means by which it can give direction to public opinion and thereby give direction to society. Those two factors exist at the same time that modern technology has created the means by which illusions can be created that are very realistic, more realistic than ever in the past. Through film, through television, music, etc., we have all kinds of means by which very compelling illusions can be created. They are very realistic, such that we now live in a time when the line between reality and fantasy is oftentimes difficult to sort out. Forrest Gump, I think, is one of the movies that drives that home. How do you know what is real? The ability to doctor pictures and make pictures look very, very authentic, and yet they have been altered from how they had originally been. It used to be that if you could show a picture of something, that was proof positive that that's the way that it was. And now with the use of computers, you can take pictures and doctor them up such that it's virtually impossible to determine that they've been doctored. The mass media has now the technology, the capability of creating very compelling fantasies. Well, you can see then how those would all fit together. If the state can produce fantasies which give the illusion of providing us with the things that we need, providing us with purpose and belonging and connection and value, in exchange for our cooperation and acquiescence, we've got ourselves a deal. Everybody's got what they want. We feel good about our lives, and the state can provide direction and take society where it wants it to go. That's the picture that Jacques Ellul paints, he paints it better than I have, but that's basically the one that he paints. And I find it very intriguing and compelling. Essentially, we want to be seduced, and the state is willing to seduce us. We want to be lied to. What is it? Tell me lies, lies, sweet little lies. We want to be lied to. We're encouraging it. And for various reasons, the state is willing to comply. Okay. Now, I want to make a couple of comments. I've been talking about the state because that's generally the term that Jacques Ellul uses. But I don't think that's exactly what he means. What he means is those who are leading society, those people who are at the forefront of society. And I don't think that means just government leaders. I think it's a combination of government leaders as well as economic leaders. And that kind of leadership that Ellul is talking about, that kind of, the term that he uses, this all comes from his book called Propaganda. But that kind of manipulation, I do not believe is orchestrated. It hasn't been centrally planned. They haven't sat down and plotted how they would do this. It's not a conspiracy. It is, I believe, the result of a long line of development in which man has found increasingly better means by which to get the desires of, for man to obtain the desires of his heart. And what has happened is we have created a means by which society as a whole allows people to get the desires of their heart and provides direction. As a result, then, society is coming to reflect ever more perfectly the true nature of man. What has been the driving force behind this? It's been the true nature of man. And the true nature of man is being manifested now in society. Okay. If this is true, then there's a sense in which we are all being victimized. We are all being manipulated by the forces that are at work. And if that's true, if it's true that all of the powers that society has that is capable of marshaling, it's marshaling for the purposes of manipulating us, then it sounds like a desperately bad mismatch. So the question is, how do we protect ourselves in such a time? There are three things that I think are really important to keep in mind. The first is, the pursuit of sexual purity is good and proper. We really ought to be pursuing sexual purity. It is the right thing to do. It is inescapable that we will feel that if that is our pursuit, we will feel out of it. We will feel out of step. But that is as it should be because we are out of step. It is, our values are different from the values of the society that surrounds us. Secondly, we are not missing out on any good thing by pursuing sexual purity. Society would tell us, would have us believe, that we are missing out on something good by not pursuing sexual pleasure. We see that in every movie, we see that in every ad, we see that in every television show. But that is all one of the lies that's being spread. And the third thing is, if what I have described is true, we are more vulnerable to the pressures of our culture If we do not have answers to the questions that to the most basic questions of what it means to be a human being, of the source of our value, what is our meaning, what is our purpose, how are we connected? If we don't have answers to those questions, then we will be vulnerable to the winds of culture. We will be susceptible to manipulation. The most fundamental and enduring answer to man's problems is God. Now, I say that with a certain amount of reluctance because that sounds so trite as to be insignificant. But it's actually a very profound answer. That all of those questions of value and meaning and purpose are all derived directly from God and can only be found in Him. The better we understand this, the more invulnerable we will be to the pressures of the culture around us. And it seems to me that the traditional answers are not even adequate. The answers that came from family and village are ultimately not adequate. But the only answers that are really adequate are the answers that derive from God Himself. So we have to find, really understand where my value rests, what my purpose in this life is. How do I get that kind of connectedness and sense of place and take those answers to heart? Now, this is no different than it's ever been. That's always been ultimately the solution to how one is able to pursue sexual purity despite the surrounding culture. But we are living in a time when gaining clarity on those issues is even more imperative than it's ever been. Okay. I left time for questions. I welcome any questions.
Is it on? If we're at a point, as you said, of not knowing the answers to those questions, and at that point you're the most easily manipulated and the most vulnerable, how is it that we should trust that God's the answer, if that's the answer you're giving us? Because we are vulnerable and easily manipulated.
What Alul talks about is this would, he spends a lot of time talking about this. But one of the things that happens in modern society is, in order for us to be manipulatable, we are really encouraged to not think. We are encouraged to respond emotionally, but not really sort things out. And he uses an interesting sentence in his book. He says, "When discussion begins, propaganda ends." That the antidote, the way to work your way out of your vulnerability and your susceptibility to manipulation is to begin to think about things, sort things out. It's not that we can't do it. It's that we are discouraged from doing it. And one can start sorting those things out and assessing them rationally. And so the solution is kind of step back and say, wait a minute, what makes sense? What makes all of the pieces fit into place rationally? And start working your way out that way. And I think that God makes the most sense rationally. Here we go into a whole course on apologetics, but I think that all of that is defensible rationally. That one can look out at the world and start making progress in that direction, that there is a God, that he is a God of order, and he is a God who cares.
I have a friend who was horrifically abused by his father from the age of 2 and thrown out on the street when he was 14, pretty much raised himself from there. One day we were talking and he said, "Do you believe homosexuality is wrong?" And I said, "Yes." And he just kind of turned into, he got very angry with me, verbally abusive. And when I started to walk out, he was surprised. And I said, I believe homosexuality is wrong, but I've never talked to any homosexual the way you just talked to me. And he, at that point, we started to really talk. And he started to cry and told me that when he was on the street, at one point there was a gang of guys that was about to rape him when a gay guy who he didn't know pulled a gun and stopped these guys from raping him. And in his mind, if this guy saved him from being raped, there couldn't be anything wrong with him being a homosexual. And I said, "Well, what if you discovered he was a racist? Couldn't he have been a racist and still done that for you? And would that have made his racism okay?" And at that point, since racism is one of his buttons, he'd say, "Well, no," but he was confused as to how to think about it then. And this sort of simplistic way of saying that if somebody is engaged in some kind of sexual practice that's bad, it needs to translate into raping people, as in Sodom, or, you know, just general nastiness.
Right.
And if those two are not connected, then on what grounds are we saying that this guy who saved him from this awful fate is evil for practicing homosexuality? So I was just wondering if you could comment about that, because so many times it feels like there's a bunch of movies out where the basic plot line is somebody either awaking from a coma or something like that, where he discovers the person he was before, he's got amnesia, now he's finding out who he was before he got amnesia, and being appalled and wondering why he wasn't appalled before the amnesia set in. And sometimes I feel like we're like that we trust perhaps our emotional reaction to determine the evilness of things too much. But where are we supposed to get this emotional reaction? What's an appropriate emotional reaction? How do we educate our emotions to recognize evil when it's evil, even if it looks soft and cuddly? Or rescuing?
It becomes, you know, we are complicated beings. There are things happening at lots of different levels in us. And the thing that human beings do best, I'm convinced, is rationalization, just self-justifying. That's what we're really good at. We're so good at it that we can't tell when aren't conscious of it ourselves. But, and so it really does become confusing in our minds when we're trying to sort out what is good and what is evil, when we have a deep-seated commitment in certain directions. We do all kinds of gymnastics to try to put two different things together that don't really fit together. And I think that's the kind of phenomenon that you're talking about. It really takes, to sort out what's right and what's wrong, takes an enormous amount of integrity and honesty to look at things squarely and say what's right and what's wrong. And that's a gift from God, I'm convinced. apart from that kind of integrity, we're always going to play games and come up with bizarre ways of putting right and wrong together. One of the things that your comments brought to mind, however, is I think that in the very near future, as we look at our society, we are going to be absolutely aghast at how much inhumanity we have inflicted on one another, how much deep psychological damage we have been inflicting on one another in our society. And yet, we've done it in ways that we can say, well, I didn't do anything wrong, I didn't do anything bad. But it's, I mean, and through sexuality, we have psychologically abused one another, sexually, physically abused one another. There are all kinds of ways in which we've abused one another, and there is going to be a legacy from that. A lot of deeply hurt people. And I think that that's going to become more and more apparent in the next few years. It's ironic that the generation that wanted to bring free love has ushered in so much horrific pain and abuse in the name of love.
Well, you've left so much time for questions. I have a bunch of follow-ups. I'm hoping I'm tracking right with what you're talking about. First of all, I want to find out when you talk about the value of democracy, are you focused on our country or Western civilization, European ideals?
What I would argue is democracy has become a worldwide value. And by that, I don't mean that every place in the world has become democratic in form of government. But even in places like Iraq and Iran, places where you don't think of them as being democratic, nevertheless, the value, the perspective that all human beings are equal and therefore have some kind of claim to have some kind of right for political say, that has become worldwide.
Okay. And tying that in with narcissism, and I'm getting that's what you mean by what will be the downfall and the symptom of a Sodom, mm-hmm. is that they tie in their self-value as a player in society, as it's what I want.
Yes.
Okay. What I'm doing is trying to take the next step and show and thinking of the symptoms of some symptoms in maybe our near surroundings and worldwide to illustrations of what's happening as we travel that road to self-value and then the narcissistic influence of whatever passion we have. And I'm thinking of the word consensual at this point of it seems to me that especially in our country and some European nations, if anything is okay, if it's consensual and we're not harming anybody else.
Right.
Is that one of the end games that you're thinking of as you look at worldwide society and this idea of narcissistic democratic rule?
Consensual with respect to how you justify an act that would otherwise be unjustifiable. Right. The nice thing about consensual is it sounds so right. I mean, if it's consensual, it must be okay. And so it's a great way to justify actions that otherwise could not be justified.
So you're thinking of a democratically lowering of the bar when it comes to morality, because there's no other measure of morality.
Right, right.
And do you see any glimmer or any ideas on a way a society can come from this conglomeration of thought that would raise the bar back up? And would it look like an Islamic nation, or would it be thought of as a repressive regime if it was to raise the bar back up to a higher moral standard for behavior of its citizens to one another?
Well, I may be wrong, but I think that there is no going back. It looks to me like what has emerged is something that is too well suited to human nature for us to go back. People would not relinquish what they've gained. So I think there's no going back. Could a society raise the bar? I think in principle the answer would be yes, but it would take a transformation of human nature. I mean, it would take something truly miraculous, truly supernatural, I think, to move things back, if I'm seeing it correctly. Because what's happened is history has taken its natural course. What we had in the Garden of Eden, the creature that God had made, has over the course of history worked out how he can live in society with others in a way that best suits his nature, that's best fitted to his nature. And what we've got is that, I think. Or at least it's the closest thing we've reached so far.
I read Jacques Ellul when I was in college, and he totally, completely depressed me. And I thought I would just put in a brief for why it's not depressing. The reason it depressed me when I was in college is I had a view of our faith as our job as Christians and as disciples of Jesus was to take the truth that Jesus brought into the world and transform society and change it and make it better and make it different. And I had what I call a sort of puritanical impulse in me that we need to make society pure, politics pure, the world pure, culture pure, and it was our job as Christian disciples to do that. The perspective that Ellul actually has that David has helped me see is there is no... Jesus didn't come into the world to fix this world. Jesus came into the world to snatch some of us out of it. And history is going to go the way history is going to go, and history is going to deteriorate, and history, as David put it, is going to show the real... It's going to come to the logical conclusion of human nature and reflect what human nature is really all about. We can't turn the tide. We can't change that. We can't transform that, nor is God asking us to. God has this story that's going to be played out in human history, and it's just going to happen the way it's going to happen. What we need to worry about is ourselves. Are we going to get swept along with the world that is being deceived? Or are we going to have the courage to think against the world and adopt different values and be different people? The reward is not going to come now. The reward is going to come in that we'll have a place in the kingdom of God in the next age. And then it doesn't look quite so hopeless if I don't think that the burden of transforming society is on us, because it looks overwhelming, because I think it is. It's an impossible task.
And I think that's very true. It's what are we going to do, and taking also a sense of responsibility for those around us. helping one another through this and helping them to grow in understanding and in clarity of perspective. But beyond that, God will do what he's going to do. That we will not be able to marshal the forces that would counteract what God has decided is going to happen. And I think it's futile to even try to do that. But we can set ourselves right with God and help those that are around us. That's a very doable task and a very worthy task.
You describe this sense of people in this culture feeling sort of like not connected and sort of without an identity or something. And then the answer you gave for that was God. And then, so I'm assuming you mean to like find identity in God. And what does that look like? Because it seems like a lot of people are falling into the same trap that you're describing in the name of finding an identity with Christianity. And, I mean, that they've just used that title to sort of encompass the sort of mindset that you're saying is problematic and creating vulnerability in us or something.
Well, what I mean is my connection, the really important connection that exists is between me and God. That's the most fundamental connection. That as I go through my life, there's a sense in which everything that happens is a transaction. It has to do with me and God. And that longing for connectedness, essentially, I think that's a longing for it to be a personal universe. And if we understand the relationship that we have with God, it is a personal relationship. That is, it is person relating to person. And I think that's really helpful. That really puts things into perspective and provides me that sense of I matter in the world, and it's not just, I'm not dealing with bureaucracy, I'm not dealing with impersonal powers, that it's God that primarily I have to deal with, and he's a person, and he knows me as a person.
So would you say that, trying to, like, in that search for, like, an identity or something to call your own, in, like, a big sense of, I mean, be it a job or something, anything, like, before you'd ever like ally yourself with just a worldly sort of, I don't know if it would be an organization or even just like a hobby, anything like that. Mm-hmm. Like something that, like what Jack was describing, the sort of recognition of that, that mindset of we don't have to change the world. This is about, sort of recognizing God's purposes, or not knowing his purposes, but recognizing that it's kind of about us seeing what he's doing in the world, or like, would that be something to find identity with?
Right, right. That's our identity is in, it's that relationship that we do have with God that gives us that both identity and purpose. Mm-hmm. Not being a member of a group, that is not a satisfying sense of identity or connectedness, ultimately.
I've been trying to figure out how your picture of sexual purity works into like watching movies in our culture. And I'm wondering if this is correct. Sexual purity wouldn't necessarily mean not going to any movies whatsoever, but not seeking out. It would be like you wouldn't be going to the movie for perhaps the sex in it. You would be going to it for the movie and
because our culture only makes movies with sex, you mm-hmm. tolerate that for mm-hmm. as much as you can. Is that right?
That's the issue that you're raising is a very good issue to which I do not have a very good answer. I think that is a very difficult one. Because there are very few movies that don't involve sex in some way or another. And usually illicit sex in some form or another. Now, can I go and watch that sort of thing without it being harmful to me? Sometimes it is clear to me that I cannot. There are some times when it seems to me that I can. But it is very difficult to sort that out. One of the things that I find really aggravating in movies is what they are asking you to do is play this game in which you agree to go along with them. They're saying, pretend this happens. And so you begin that pretending process. And as a result, they say, we're taking you into this illusion, this fantasy, you come with us and pretend that it's real. And when you do that, there's a sense in which you are granting them permission to take you wherever they want to take you. And it's not uncommon for me to be in a movie and at some point in the movie become upset because I realize that where they've taken me is to condone something that I know is not right. Something like the movie, I know that this is dated, it's one of the last movies I saw in a movie theater, but it's the Titanic. But that movie is crafted to make you think a certain way about the relationship between whoever the stars are, I can't remember who they are. But if you step back and you look at it, that's really a rotten relationship that they are encouraging you to applaud and feel good about. That's an amazing thing. And movies do that all the time. They take you to where emotionally you're saying, yes, yes, that's great, that's wonderful, that's the way it should be. But if you step back and you look at it, you say, that's contrary to everything that I believe. How did this happen? That's if we're aware of it. It can happen without us ever becoming aware of it. And that's what I find disturbing. But it's that ability of the media to make that which is actually perverse seem beautiful. And it has that power. It's not only true of sex scenes. It does that with respect to other kinds of values as well. Taking values that are perverse and making them appear noble and good. So what should we be seeing? What kinds of movies should we be watching? I don't know. I have developed a low tolerance for movies in general, and so I don't see a lot of them. Because I've had so many of those experiences where either it has led me to believe that something's good that I know to be wrong, or it encourages me to be kind of a voyeur in something that I ought not be seeing. I mean, if I were walking down the street and looked in a window and saw that, I'd look away. I mean, I'd be ashamed. But there in the movie, we're all eating popcorn and fixed on it and staring at it. And feel like that's just what we should be doing. So I think it's really difficult because movies are doing all kinds of things to us, and I'm not sure all of what they're doing to us, but some of what they're doing to us is bad. is really perverting, is really influencing us to have values that we ought not have.
So, I mean, I realize, like, other forms, like books and music and things like this, perhaps they have a different level of persuasion, but maybe it's just something. I'm having a hard time separating, like, people I know who completely isolate themselves from everything in the world and seeing that as pure, and this isolating yourself sort of from these sorts of things. Like, I don't know, what's the difference between those two?
Between isolating yourself and...
Isolating yourself. from, like, you not going to movies and this other person I know not going to movies, uh-huh, because they consider themselves pure. And...
Well, it seems to me we have no choice but to one degree or another to be engaged with the culture. Mm-hmm. It's... we live in it. We raise our families in it. We can't really isolate ourselves from it, I don't think, and yet, and still be functioning members of our community. I mean, that we have to be. So I'm not in favor of isolation from the culture. But the problem is, I'm a sinner. And I'm very well aware of the impact that kind of stuff can have on me. Now, you had suggested earlier to go to a movie, there would be two different reasons you would go to a movie and see it, and you're looking at a sex scene. One would be to kind of vicariously enjoy the sex scene, and the other would be more distantly to look at it as a part of a movie, of the movie as a whole, or something like that. I can't do that. That I know that if I went saying that that's what I was going to do, I'd be lying to myself. It's just, I'm constitutionally incapable of having that kind of distance. And I know that about myself. And therefore, I'm very, very concerned about that. I mean, something like pornography. I've heard of people who will buy something like Playboy and look at it for the, just so they improve their knowledge of the culture. Can't do that. I mean, that's, I know I'd be lying to myself. I mean, it's just, I would like to think that would be a possibility, but I know that I can't do that. That's messing with fire. So, but I know that not everyone is affected the same way I am by things. I mean, I think that there are people who probably could watch a movie and not be pulled in the way that I would be. But I am just very cautious about, I know myself too well, and I don't want to lie to myself. I don't want to even test it. But that's difficult, because that means there are very few movies I can go to.
David, I think one of the things that we haven't talked about is there's a lot of pressure when you feel like not going to these things, that you feel like you're this Puritan, or even amongst Christians, I feel like that sometimes when I say, yeah, I can't watch that. And I may give reasons why, but I still feel like I'm even on the out, you know, of even amongst my friends sometimes when I say, this is what I see. Right. I mean, I, came to this conclusion after watching cable television. I mean, it could have been like watching a Playboy in my mind, in a sense, because I watched for like a weekend. And my conclusion was that the role of women is to show their breasts and dance with each other. And the role of men is to oogle them. Mm-hmm. So if our culture is that, I mean, I don't see how people can separate themselves. I mean, when they're at work, what do they do? If their leisure time is spent doing these other things, how can they work with each other? I mean, those kind of things come up. It's
right.
A dangerous world in that way. If you choose to go, that's not for me. And I mean, I feel uncomfortable when I say, oh, that's not okay when she does this on the television show or, you know, that sort of thing. And I feel like I'm the one going, I have to turn off the television. And I think that's where it feels hard. And I think even when I was in college, I mean, that was a hard line for me. Sometimes I'd be sucked in with my peers because I knew I was the one that was feeling like a Puritan. So I'd go, okay, I'll do what you want me to do. I mean, that sort of thing, because I didn't want to feel on the out, even though I have convictions and beliefs about something.
Right, right. Those things are really tough. And the problem is we can end up communicating a judgmentalism that's not really appropriate, a self-righteousness is not appropriate. The fact is, it is difficult to know how to deal with these kinds of influences. And people are going to make different decisions. And part of that is going to stem from the fact that we're different people. And to a certain extent, we are going to respond to things differently. And I think we have to cut each other a lot of slack. And hope that they too will cut us a lot of slack. That if I decide not to watch a certain movie, but I have a Christian friend who decides that that's just fine, I don't know that I want to announce it and say, I won't go to that movie. On the one hand, we just have to do what we think is right. And be humble about it, because we're just doing the best we can. We're all just kind of bumbling through this process. No one's going to do it all right, so we just have to make each decision as best we can as they come along. It's tough. We live in a very difficult world, and it seems to me that it is getting increasingly difficult as I look at the world that my children are growing up in. They have pressures that I did not have. So it's becoming more and more difficult, not easier. Things like pornography on the internet. And that's, we obviously do not have the right software, because every time I check my mail, it's amazing how many pornographic things pop up as messages, and that's that. Those are just incredible pressures. So things are getting tougher, not easier.
One of the approaches that I use that works for me for more than just sexual material is, I've sort of identified a little emotional response that I get I've named to myself a tug, that if I'm in a movie and I feel a tug, or I'm listening to music or reading a book and I feel a tug in a wrong direction, whether it's sexual or not, depending upon the strength of the tug, I may or may not shut it down. If I just notice that it's just a little bit of a tug, and I can interact with that tug and say, that's wrong, I don't feel anything. It's sort of like the difference between standing in a gentle breeze and standing in the open door of a 747 at 35,000 feet. You know, if I feel like I'm going to be sucked out of the airplane, I get the hell out of there. That I'm even close to that. Sometimes I can feel a tug, and it's not necessarily sexual. I've felt tugs towards believing that forgiveness is not appropriate When is forgiveness not appropriate? Mm-hmm. Or tugs to feeling, tugged towards some new age temptations that I experienced before I was a Christian. Just sort of, it's hard to describe what that kind of a tug feels like, but I know what it feels like to myself, and I know it's dangerous for me. It might not be dangerous for somebody else. So part of it is, I guess, maybe knowing your own vulnerabilities and stuff like the Titanic. I didn't feel any particular tug. Well, I felt a tug in the sense that it's hard not to feel some kind of tug when you see two people who are aroused. But at the same time, I think Leonardo DiCaprio is a dweeb. and so I know I'm probably in the minority, but so it didn't. It wasn't hard for me to say that's wrong, that's silly. But other things, there have been other movies that I have walked out of. There is a movie, Brimstone and Treacle, with Sting is one of the stars. And when I was first came to the study center, I and Doug Grotheis and a couple of other people went to this thing, and there was a point at which it was like, uh-oh, this is the door of the 747, and Doug felt it too, and we left and the other two stayed. I know we're supposed to cut each other a lot of slack, but I'm thinking those other two should have left too. I'd be really surprised if they weren't standing at the door of the 747. Mm-hmm. So I guess everybody has different thresholds for the tugs in particular directions, different vulnerabilities, and I think part of it has to do with being able to identify when you're being tugged, how strongly, if you're really in danger, or is it just a matter of being aware that there's a tug there that you can just say, you can just lean backwards and everything's fine. And then being true to that, not allowing yourself to be tugged in a direction that you shouldn't be tugged. Mm-hmm.